therapy is not for the broken. For heaven's sake, we get a colonoscopy and we get our oil changed twice a year. And we're willing to let people see us in our physical vulnerability for dental checkups or for whatever we're doing. Why on earth wouldn't we pop the hood emotionally occasionally? Let's let ourselves function at peak performance. And that may mean checking in with our own selves therapeutically and letting someone else kind of guide us through for a brief moment. That's a good thing.
Welcome to Backseat Driver. I'm your host, Nikki Bennett, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm here to help you navigate the twists and turns of life using real-world advice from me and my guests. Together, we illustrate how our greatest struggles often wind up being our greatest strengths. Thanks for listening. This past week, my husband and I really got into a tango. I got into a serious tango, okay? And there were like a couple months leading up to it where my husband, one of his favorite childhood movies is Snowball Express. And so I don't know if you've seen that, but this family buys a ski resort and it's just chaos, right? But he loves this movie. So we watched this together before Christmas and he came to me shortly after and said, I want to buy a ski resort. I said, you're crazy. Like, we have this goal. I don't know, for our listeners, we had Taylor Hartman on. He's the author of The Color Code. And he talks about personality. Well, Ben and I are both yellows. And yellows are driven by fun and adventure. And they're playful. And they can sometimes be really irresponsible. And my secondary is blue, which is a perfectionist and kind of controlling type. So that tends to take over in our relationship because we need a parent, right? So he comes to me and he's like, our goal as a yellow couple is to buy these vacation rentals and eventually sell our home and just travel with our kids. So we've got two so far, one in the mountains and one in Hawaii. Wow. And we were going to buy two more. Well, he's suddenly disrupting our plan and wants to buy a ski resort. And so I'm like, that all sensitive, fits together, of course. Right? Of course it does. It's just a little diversion. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to squish him because he's yellow and I don't want him to resent me as that controlling blue partner. So I'll just sort of play along with this and nothing's going to really happen, right? But he's so determined. He's got like secondary red. So this starts coming into play and he starts talking with this guy and talking with investors. And I'm like, I just need you to know that like I'm 99.9% out. Like, this is not happening. And his response, you know where this is going. His response is like, okay, so there's a chance, right? So, so he starts pursuing it. And I'm like white knuckling over in the corner, holding my breath, thinking like, this has just got to fall apart. And he comes to me and says, oh, it's sold. And I'm like, whew, I dodged that bullet, right? But no, he calls the guy and he's like, listen, does this other investor want a partner? Or if things fall apart, let me know. And so things start going down that road. And the guy's like, well, I have a buyer, but he's kind of flaking on me. So I'd love to talk with you and see what you're interested in. And but he is not letting these hurdles slow him down, like certainly not stop, but not slow down at all. So he keeps going and going and going. And then it's, hey, this week, I want to go down to White Pine. It's in Wyoming. It's about an hour and a half from Jackson Hole. Okay. And I want to check out this resort. And I'm going, you don't even like skiing anymore with our kids because it's too much work. Like, what are you doing? And so we got into it and I totally was triggered. I was like, this is not, I'm not going. I'm not interested. You could find someone else to go with. And so then he proceeds to make plans to go with my son and a couple friends and things just go from bad to worse. Like, now we're not talking. I'm getting the death stare when he walks in the room. He's getting like mumbles under my breath. So tell our listeners, like, what was going on beneath the surface? I mean, what are the causes of these types of problems? And I could tell you what I finally came to on my own.
You want me to tell you what you were thinking? That this is
No. I want you to tell us what, when there's a problem, you said it's three things. It's one of three things, right? 99% of the time.
99% of the time. We are, by our natures, looking to feel safe and secure and loved. loved and valued, I consider a package deal, but safe and secure and loved, safe that we can feel what we feel and that we're not going to be in jeopardy of critique or in jeopardy of being squashed or steamrolled, secure that we know what we can count on and expect and predict, and loved and valued in the sense that we know that we hold a high value priority to the other person and that they will hold to that and they will help us feel that from their perspective of seeing us. And so I can only imagine that you probably felt very little predictability about what was coming next. And you probably didn't feel as safe about opening up and sharing what was going on for you for fear of the storm that would surely bring. And maybe you felt disregarded that your place in the whole conversation and equation was being lowered and left as kind of to pick up the tab of what was left over.
You nailed it. You totally nailed it. But it took me a good week to figure that out. It took me like calling my sister and venting, which I know isn't the healthiest thing, but she's my person. And so I would call and say like, he's just, because he said to me, he's like, you know, ever since I was 10, I've dreamt of these different businesses. And I'm like, well, when I was 10, I was playing MASH. I don't know if you know what MASH is. You know what MASH is?
No, but I'm interested.
Okay, it's this game where it's mansion, apartment, shack, or house.
Oh, I remember this game.
Right? And then you have four partners and that's four right. numbers of children. And I said, at 10, I was playing MASH and I had myself married to a movie star living in a mansion with 12 kids. But it's time to grow up. Which then left him feeling belittled, unseen, unheard, unsafe. And so we just got into this. I mean, it was like a total gridlock. It was not good. And so finally, we had a counseling appointment actually with Dr. Hartman on Friday, and it did not go well. I was not my centered self. I was very blue. I was very judgmental. And I realized after that I was just scared to speak my truth, which was that I felt totally unimportant and totally unseen and totally unsafe. And I think he did too. And we ended up having a conversation, which... This is so embarrassing, but I'm just going to be real here because it's the only thing I know how to do. There was a Barbie on the counter and I picked this Barbie up and I did a total role play. I was like, listen, I'm you and Barbie is me. Nikki, you need to go sit in the corner and mind your own business because I'm the lead of this household and what I say goes. Anyway, it was pretty hysterical.
Well, fantastic, but actually, that's great.
We got that. Somewhere.
You pulled a sand tray right there. It worked.
I totally did. So tell our listeners, like, obviously we're both feeling the same thing and needing the same thing. So how do you reconcile that? How do you help your partner feel seen and heard and validated and safe when you're not feeling seen, heard, validated, or safe?
Well, it's not easy. I don't think that there's a perfect recipe. Even the best clinicians in the field who publish about these things all the time, I would say that there's some variability in how they would bring that about. To me, the kind of the clinch pin, the biggest thing in the room whenever a couple is struggling is that we first have to reestablish safety. That's the first thing that has to come back. And so emotional safety, most especially. And so we have to feel like the other person is seeing us, that they can help us to feel that lowering our own wall is not a risk we are unwilling to take. And the vehicle by which we make things feel safe again is by empathic response. So our empathy can be manifested in reflecting words, softening our tone, having a body language that shows that we're not on the offense, that we are ready to receive. It's about casual affection and it's about proximity and it's about gentleness in the simple ways that help the other person to know like, oh, okay, I can be here and I'm not at risk of being squashed. I'm not on the firing line ready to be damaged or set aside. If we can get to a point where that's a thing, where we can kind of reestablish safety first and foremost, then that facilitates a conversation. I always think of this as being, we have to kind of take turns, right? That there's no one person that gets to always be the first vocalizer or expresser of feelings. But in the equation of our relationships, we have to have three things kind of sequentially happen. First, we have to identify that deeper core feeling that's going on for us, which will inevitably have an attachment need that preceded even that. But we have to be able to identify that deeper down core feeling and voice it in a way that doesn't put the other person on the defense. And then we have to, the other person has to be able to empathize with that and give it valid ground. And the beauty about empathy is that it doesn't require any agreement. We don't have to agree 1 ounce to have good empathy. And so if we can extend empathy and let the other person know that they do have a valid reason to feel this way, I can see it through your eyes, not just my own. If we can help the other person feel that they are safe to have their feelings, that they are feeling something that has validity, then the next step is that their walls will then have reason to drop. They'll feel more at ease, more at peace. They'll feel less need to hyper defend or ramrod their issue into the other person's throat. And then they will be able at least to welcome a discussion about solutions, which might include apologies and what next and problem resolution and what are we going to do about this and boundaries and such. The struggle for most couples is that they will fumble the ball in the first step and they will deliver a surface feeling, which is more reactive in its nature. Like, I'm so upset. I'm so angry about this thing and this thing and this thing, which by its very nature is very difficult to empathize with. And very often will leave the other person feeling that they're on the defense anyway, or they'll share a core emotion in a way that makes the other person feel wrong anyway. Like, well, I'm really sad right now, but we both know why. Or I'm really hurt inside, but this isn't the first time, is it? I mean, just a gentle portion of the sprinkling of guilt, if you will.
Right.
And couples will fumble that ball initially, making it almost impossible to really bring healthy empathy into the room. Or they will bypass empathy altogether and jump prematurely to solutions. And you see that happen with couples that try to give a lot of solutions all of a sudden, or a lot of the answers or the advice or a fast apology. Oh, I'm sorry for everything. I'm sorry, I'm a terrible husband. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Whether sincere or flippant, either way, it's out of place. And we owe ourselves a favor to not try and solve it or fix it at all until empathy has taken the stage. And so when it comes to how do we do this with a couple when both people are hurt, the compromise, if you can call it that, I hate the true sense of the word compromise. I feel like we end up resenting things by virtue of what I had to give up so that we could get this. Mm-hmm. I prefer the concept of willful middle ground. I can talk about that later if you're ever curious. But my idea is that we would both of us give space for the other person to identify a core emotion, and that when a core emotion has been laid on the table, the first thing that must happen is we have to let that be a safe thing to have occurred. We have to let the other person know that that was not a foolish gesture. It wasn't a risk that will go unappreciated. So we stop everything. We don't necessarily set our own points down and believe that the other person is right. I dare say there is no right and wrong when it comes to hurt feelings. It's just feelings. So I stop everything. I embrace and appreciate what the other person is feeling, to the point that they now feel that their emotions were okay to have and that they feel seen, and then we flip roles. This all happening before we get to solutions at all. And now the person who had been listening will now share and they'll say, and this is what was going on for me, not as a rebuttal, but as an addition to what's going on. I want you to know my heart. This is where I'm at. I feel this. This is real for me. And then the other person who had initially spoken now gets to hear it and soak it in and be an empathic listener. And then with both of our walls down, then solutions work.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. It's such a hard thing to do in the moment. I think, you know, that shame creeps in and that fear of vulnerability. And I know one of my issues is when I'm grabbed, I turn into the ice queen. It's like my tone, my everything, my facial expressions, like I cannot hide my emotions. I always tell my clients that I will never BS you because I can't. Like even if I tried, anything I say to you that's a compliment or otherwise is totally sincere. I cannot not, right? Yeah. Speak my truth. So one of the things I've learned to do, and I don't know, you can coach me on this. When I'm triggered that way, I'll show up and say, hey, I need to speak my truth, but I need you to know that my wall is up. I don't like my tone right now. And so my delivery is going to be sloppy. So hopefully you can hear my words through my outward like expression. Is that a good way to handle it when you're, and usually when, as soon as I say that, my wall comes down and I'm able to be more vulnerable, but in the moment it's like, I'm saying the right words, but they're coming across very like robotic.
Yeah. I do think it's a very authentic place to be, which is a good thing. We always want to seek to be authentic. And again, I want to just emphasize, I don't think that there's necessarily a perfect right way to do this. This is just a one take on it, right? From what I'm hearing you share. But I would believe that it comes down to something like this. Our emotions consistently arrive in two levels. There's and Susan Johnson, the author of Emotion Focused Therapy, she talks about this in terms of primary and secondary emotion. I prefer to think of it as core and surface, but mm-hmm. it's the same idea that there will be reactive emotions surface in their nature, like anger and irritability and mad and frustrated and defensive and guarded and sometimes indifferent. And those emotions, they all come as a reaction to something in the core that happened first. And the core emotions will be things like pain, fear, hurt, rejection, mm-hmm. abandonment, loneliness, feeling inadequate, guilt and shame, depression, anxiety, feeling unloved, overlooked, betrayed, confused, and trust and safety and joy and peace, the good mm-hmm. stuff too. But from the unpleasant core will come the reactive surface. And so when you described that a moment ago, what it sounded like to me is you're owning the fact that I'm having a surface emotion right now. This is very real for me. And it's not easy for me to go purely deeply into my core just yet, but I'm working on it. I want there. I want that to be where I'm going. And I'm just inviting you to the table to help me get there and to know that that's okay. And from that perspective, I think that's perfectly reasonable. In fact, there's a lot of value to that because we're inviting our partner to the table in our own vulnerability. And that in itself is already a gesture of high love, that we are seeking to be vulnerable to such a degree that we want the other person to see us, even in our moments of discomfort, even in our raw places when we're not quite sure exactly how to paint the picture or say the right words. So we invite them in. We share that we are, yes, indeed, at this reactive place. I'm tense. I'm defensive. I feel myself angry. It's real for me. And then as quickly as we possibly can, I would just say, let's link that to the core. I'm feeling defensive and cold and rigid. And I know that about myself. And I believe it's because I'm feeling overlooked. I'm feeling hurt. I'm feeling disappointed. I'm feeling irrelevant, or I'm feeling small in your eyes, whatever the emotion, right? And if we can share that core, the empathy that's going to be extended, I would hope would have almost no reference to the surface emotion. There may be a moment to say, sure, I can see you're angry. But most importantly, most especially, we're trying to tap into the core so that you would now feel not only is my core emotion valid to have, but it's being readily seen. And mm-hmm. and it's, if I may, just one last example is I think of this kind of like when you go to a movie, you step into a movie and the film director who created this big expensive piece, what they're wanting to do is they want to suspend your disbelief. And so the lights turn down low, the volume is jacked up very high, the screen is enormous, and we're told to turn off all of our electronics. And the idea being is that we're trying to immerse ourselves into the film. And if we start to join the film, the director is winning, right? The director is getting the point across. We have now entered this movie. And then, of course, if popcorn flies or a baby cries or a cell phone goes off or the lights flicker, well, we're jolted out of it for a moment. We're reminded that we're in a theater. But then we try and enter back into that zone again, right? Well, in our relationship, we're trying to do the same thing. We're trying to suspend our disbelief, set aside whatever we feel strongly about or what may contradict our view from theirs, and just join their movie. So if your husband is going to empathize with you, he's not going to continue to wave the flag of what he sees and what he insists upon. He's just going to stop, knowing full well that empathy doesn't acquiesce. He's not giving in to you being right or you having the higher position. There is no moral high ground in emotional experience. It's just emotion. So he's going to care deeply that you felt it. He's going to join your movie. And in that movie, he's going to appreciate what it is that you're trying to convey. And he's going to feel it in real time with you. And then share you his movie.
I love that. You know, what's so interesting to me is how quickly this works, because I'm realizing I need to go give Ben a big pat on the back. Like, he handled this like a movie star. I mean, he stopped and he looked at me with the eyes of death, but he said, I can totally see how you would feel the way that you felt. I can see how you felt invisible and you felt small and you felt unsafe. And I can see how I've contributed to that over the years. And I don't ever want you to feel that way. And I'm really sorry. And it was like in that instant, you know, and then he went on to say, like, I'm not going to do this because you're more important to me than anything else. And in that moment, I came around so quickly that I was like, well, wait a minute. Maybe we I wanted to sort of push him to do it because I felt like I was squashing his hopes and dreams. So it's interesting how quickly that little bit of empathy turns things around.
Yeah. Yeah. Powerful stuff. I think we are craving empathic validation so much that when it's meaningfully provided, it's very difficult for us not to see the need and even the craving for us to reciprocate it.
So what would you do in a situation where one partner showed up that way and the other person, like one person was totally vulnerable, spoke their truth, and the other person didn't give them that? I mean, I guess this is where marriage therapy walks into the picture, right? Hopefully. But what do you do in those situations where the other person's just like, I mean, I think of a few people in my life I know that would show up as like, no, like no empathy, no compassion, no validation, sort of stubborn, rigid. Yeah.
Well, it's certainly very common. I think that happens for people, partially because their past experience may have burned them and they may have learned that being vulnerable or emotionally exposed is going to be a dangerous thing, or that it's not going to get them the ultimate end game that they're looking to have. And so by their nature and their experience, they've learned to stay walled off, closed off, and more hesitant or restrictive about their emotional exposure. But I would say that just like in therapy, they often will talk about this in some of the EFT therapy conferences that I have attended. They'll say, if you find yourself angry at a client, or if you find yourself not understanding their position, it's because your empathy is incomplete. And I used to think, well, you know what? Sometimes there are couples that will sit down with me and they'll start talking and I cannot see any valid ground from one of them, or sometimes both of them, but especially one of them. And I will, in my mind, already be creating kind of a war path of putting them in their place, right?
Right.
A tone that doesn't help and ultimately won't get them anywhere. But I would say that the task at hand as a therapist who's working with a couple always ends up being, can I, for a long enough time for it to mean something, can I step into their movie and appreciate that the movie is real? Well, if I'm trying to do this and I'm sincerely trying to empathize, or if in a couple, if one partner is sincerely trying to empathize with another person, with their partner, and if they still get a coldness back, that the other person is not yielding, will not open, will not allow softening, then to me, the task at hand is just to go back and repeat the same cycle of what we've been doing, because walls are not up without good reason. So I often will think of it like a cabin. Like if you go to a one-room rustic cabin for the weekend and the heat goes out and it's just you and your partner and it's getting colder by the minute, and you see that the temperature dropping, it's going to just, you're going to die if you don't find a way to stay warm. And on this particular night, you're fighting, so you're not going to keep each other physically warm. The task at hand then is, how am I going to ride out this cold? Well, most people in that situation will just pile on the layers, more parkas, more blankets, more sweaters, whatever you've got to ride out the evening. And then therapeutically speaking, a therapist will come along and say, you know, gosh, you're so guarded. You have so many layers on, so many walls up. That doesn't work. You really got to take off your blankets and your coats. But that's a stupid thing to say if the person feels that the climate is frigid. Why would I do that? Why would I expose myself to frigid temperature unless I had good reason to believe that warmth was on its way? And that's really where it comes down to. There is no heat source in the cabin other than a fireplace in the corner that, if stoked with logs, the logs being empathy, if both of us contribute some logs to that fireplace, well, sure, not only can the room warm up and not only can then I take off a layer or two, but after a while, it'll become foolish not to. I'll feel out of place by keeping the extra layers on because the warmth makes it almost uncomfortable to stay guarded. And so if you see that your partner is cold and they're not ready to open up and share what's going on, then the question at hand isn't, what are you doing? The question is, how can I help you feel warm enough to let the walls come down, to let the parka come off? How can I warm up this room? And sometimes it'll be gentle affection. Sometimes it'll be going back and reflecting and validating and expressing emotion in a reflective way once again. Sometimes it'll be just softening our tone so that they feel like there's nothing left to defend. But inevitably, I would believe that's the recipe. No, mix and match the circumstance with different couples. I think sometimes it takes some repetition for people who are fully prepared by instinct to believe that they're about to be under fire. It's very difficult for them to feel ready to stay emotionally exposed. And I think sometimes, even despite our best of efforts, and we think that we've given good empathy, sometimes we have to do it again. And the delivery of empathy is never supposed to be measured by the giver. It's supposed to be measured by how well it's received.
I love that. You know, one thing I'm learning the longer I do this is the more I learn, the less I know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So question for you. Where my head's going is my husband and I have worked with Dr. Hartman a lot, and he is like not gentle, not like there's not a lot of empathy or gentleness. It's like smackdown, like WWF for us. And I'm a firm believer in like when the student's ready, the teacher appears, that old Chinese proverb. So maybe for us, it's different, but I think with that, with him, we've made so much more progress, particularly with my husband, because he's just been so direct and so brutal at times. Like, I can't tell you the number of times that my husband was like, I was planning to walk out today because I knew I was getting the smackdown, but he came back. But I'm realizing as we're talking, I think the reason he keeps coming back is he knows that he feels loved and seen, and he feels trust in Dr. Hartman, probably because he grew up with him. He knows him. He knows that Taylor loves him. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Well, anytime that we can feel safe, I'm not sure exactly what your husband might've felt, but I would just conjecture that anytime that we feel safe from the support that we're being given, from the supportive person by history or by experience, if we know that this person is someone that is a known commodity, we know that they are someone I can trust, someone that is predictable, someone that I can count on to have a very similar expected stance or response, I think that facilitates our ability to hold hope and to engage even when logic says not to. And so perhaps in some way that your husband, knowing this therapist, this professional, maybe your husband feels like, this is someone that I can predict. I can expect to show up in a certain way, right or wrong, good or bad. I know them and I know how it'll be. And so I can count on that. And that in itself provides us a lot of assurance. I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people don't want to lower their walls, is that if they get to a point where vulnerability is on the table and they're dealing with a bunch of wild cards, it's going to be a very difficult process to stay guarded. We can kind of have flash moments of being unguarded, but out of a sheer preservation of self, we want to keep the walls back up. So anyway, I guess I would want to instill in a partnership predictability whenever it's possible. And maybe that's what he's getting from Dr. Hartman.
Yeah, my mind's kind of spinning around this, and I don't mean to derail us, but I'm just thinking of my children too, my oldest two. They saw somebody else for a year or so, and it was helpful. And then they both met with Dr. Hartman, and he just has this way of conveying like love and connection, but he does not hold back. I mean, it's like the stern father. And they both, I thought, oh, how is this? Because they don't have a history with him. They'd never met him. But they both came away feeling like, wow, I got more out of that one session. And what my older son said was, I trusted that he would tell me the truth and he's not going to BS me. So I guess there's something here too about genuineness and that. My other question is, tell me how, I'm taking a course this weekend on brain spotting. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
A little bit, probably not as much as you are. Keep me going.
You have had like 20 hours in a chair, but it's blowing my mind. So it's like EMDR, although it seems to be more generalized. It seems to sort of clean more areas of trauma at once versus like EMDR, you have to go through every single little trauma. Brain spotting's more generalized.
Okay.
And so I've got a lot of trauma, like we all do. We have little T's and big T's, so I've been doing brain spotting since August. I just felt compelled to reach out and see what it was like. I've been doing it personally, and I thought, well, I want to get trained in this. As I'm learning about the nervous system and nervous system responses, you know, the fight, flight, or freeze, or the polyvagal shutdown, I'm realizing, I don't know if you're familiar with The Body Keeps the Score, Bessel van der Kolk. Yeah. I'm realizing that for me and for a lot of my clients, that no matter how much talking therapy we're doing in the chair, in a moment when you're triggered, it's like your prefrontal cortex, your logic and reasoning brain is totally offline. And so sometimes some of this trauma work needs to be done first. How do you see that fitting in with attachment theory? And how do you work around those types of issues where somebody say they've been married for a long time and maybe their husband has an addiction or there's been abuse or something that's like repetitive where it's not safe for them to connect in this way? What would you suggest, or what are your thoughts around that?
Well, I would say first of all, there's a lot of trauma specialists who are skilled in working with this specifically, that they're a meaningful resource. And I always encourage couples that if they do have, you know, big T kind of trauma that has loomed over them for a long time, don't be afraid of jumping right to the horse's mouth, so to speak, and talking to someone who has a lot of extensive experience with trauma. However, in concept, and I think many clinicians who may be prepared to step into this with a lot of gentle finesse, what we need to do, I think what is most useful to do, is to help people to do the same kind of foundational safety, but to do so with the understanding that in trauma, it isn't about logic. It isn't about what we can explain through evidence or proof. I think sometimes couples get stuck there because when a trauma exists, emotions are true regardless of what someone can explain, regardless of what someone can prove. And so if we make an agreement to leave logic and reasoning at the door and instead make emotional experience the biggest thing in the room, and our emotional response, our empathetic response, being the second most important thing in the room, well, then it at least facilitates the possibility that we can have a safe exchange. And little by little, we can start to warm up that cabin and give people the chance to talk about it in slow, small measure. I think it's important also that if there is significant history of trauma at play, there may be a need for gently dipping your toes in the water and then having the mutual understanding that may be all that I can do for now. And then we step out and then we come back and we do it again. And sometimes we might go an inch further into the water and that might be as far as we can go. And that's okay. That delay is not wasted time, because any time that we are able to help our partners who have been traumatized or who have incurred emotional scar tissue, if we can help them to feel that coming to the table, coming to the pool wasn't a foolish gesture. This was not dangerous. It was scary, but the danger was low. As long as we can help instill that, then just like the term that was used for years was exposure therapy, that if we can expose ourselves very, very gently to risk and to gentle stimulus, and then allow ourselves to prove to our own self that our psyches are not in an immediate danger, that there's less risk than we feared there had been, well, then we can slowly train our nervous system to show up and to stay shown up, to be present and to not run. Now, there's a history of extensive things that we might do to protect ourselves, but those things they're both physiological, as you're describing with this fight or flight or freeze, as they are emotional. They're linked together. I had a conversation with my brother, who's a psychiatrist, and he described this to me the other day in a podcast that I thought was interesting. He said that if 10,000 years ago you were walking along in a jungle and you could see that ahead of you, perhaps 100 yards away, there was a tiger that was coming around the corner, and that tiger eyed you and you eyed it, that there would be a series of physiological responses that would immediately kick on, all of which would support survival. You know, our eyes would dilate. We would start to engage in as much peripheral vision as we can to kind of see the layout. How can I survive? Where could I go? Where could I turn? And the blood will be shunted away from our stomach and from our non-essential regions in our body so that our muscles can have maximum blood flow and maximum strength, and adrenaline kicks on and all the things. All of those physiological responses being a preparation so that I can make it through this next bit. Mm-hmm. And you know, zoom forward 10,000 years, we may not have a tiger coming around the corner, but our versions of tigers will be as children, it may be a perpetrator, someone who has brought abuse to our world, someone who is dominating us or extending unhealthy control in a variety of different ways. As an adult, it may be loss, or it may be unexpected surprise or rejection or abandonment, or it might be feeling an inability to show ourselves to our partner and have them show their heart and themselves to us. But either way, big T, small T, like you were saying, if we experience danger of all of its sort, there will indeed be a more sophisticated version of that primitive tiger that was approaching us before. Our systems were primed then, and our systems are primed now. And it's not strange that people get GI problems and heart palpitations and migraines and muscle tension and stiffness and a lot of adrenaline response. That's not strange. It's actually quite normal. And so anxiety conditions that kick on and our trauma response, it's very much a pattern and a process of our nervous systems trying to keep us safe. And so if we can normalize that a bit, then that means that when our partner has been traumatized and we may have a need to have a conversation therapeutically about connecting better or getting past strain or tension or walls, if trauma has been on the table, as it has for many of us, then the conversation simply can't be, here's the logic of why you need to open up, because logic's irrelevant. What is relevant is that physiologically, my system is primed for protection. And I need to show my system that there's nothing currently that needs to defend or be protected from.
I love that. That's such a good thought. And it's true. I mean, as you're talking, my mind is really having to be stretched because I've for so long been conditioned by different helpers. Like, it's all about logic and reason over emotion. We can't let our emotions drive our decisions, which can be true. And in, you know, for somebody like me who deals with anxiety over everything, I've got to use logic and reason or I'm going to become agoraphobic and not leave my house. However, as you're speaking, this just makes so much sense to me. It is about the underlying emotion. Like, what is it in me that doesn't feel safe? What is the root of my need to feel hypervigilant? Where is that coming from? So are you really stretching my thinking? I love it.
Well, and there's no shortage of different perspectives on how this works. I believe in this attachment theory and this accessing our emotional core this way. But I know that there's a lot of therapists who might come at it from a slightly different angle. And at the end of the day, different modalities, different approaches, different thought processes. But I think it comes down to, can we help people to feel a reason to show up and then to stay with their walls down? And mix and match the verbiage and the explanations for how we get there. I think ultimately that's the goal.
I love it. And I loved what you said in one of your podcasts about, you know, no matter what, who you are as a person, where you're from, what your culture is, what your upbringing is, we all have those three needs, which are, again, to feel safe, to feel loved, and to feel seen. Is that it?
Safe and secure and loved. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It just makes so much sense to me. And it's interesting because, you know, as I start learning one thing, I feel like, again, all those teachers appear. And so this just really coincides with everything else I'm learning about trauma and attachment. And I'm just so grateful you're here today. What would you say to our listeners who maybe have trauma, maybe don't, maybe they're just stuck in an argument over a ski resort? What would your advice be? Where can they learn more about the work you do? Where can they seek support? What would you say to them?
Well, I guess first and foremost, therapy is not for the broken. I think sometimes we cast therapy into a very limited range of usefulness. And I think it's less so now, but I think historically people have seen therapy as crisis intervention for only those who are at the worst of places. And we try our best to never need it. And I think if we can throw that on its side and acknowledge that all of us will be in places of emotional repair. For heaven's sake, we get a colonoscopy and we get our oil changed twice a year, and we're willing to let people see us in our physical vulnerability for dental checkups or for whatever we're doing. Why on earth wouldn't we pop the hood emotionally occasionally? Let's let ourselves function at peak performance. And that may mean checking in with our own selves therapeutically and letting someone else kind of guide us through for a brief moment. That's a good thing. And so willful vulnerability, I think, is an asset that we often overlook. So whether we are, whether we're trying to overcome a history of things that have trained us to be guarded and protective, or whether we have smaller things in our here and now in our day-to-day relationships that could be improved or enhanced, either way, willful vulnerability, either with a counselor, with a therapist, or with a partner and a child and a friend, that sometimes with our own self, that process becomes immeasurably valuable. There's just no way to overstate how big of a deal it is to access what's real and raw and authentic and personally, emotionally relevant to us, and then to work with it at that level. So one of the things that I often will encourage is for people to seek out meaningful check-ins. So whether you have conversations with regularity with your partner, where you talk about a core emotion every day, it doesn't have to be anything big. It can be simply, I love you, but say why. Don't just say, I love you because. Give it something a little bit more than the compulsory thing to say. And if we can go to a zone where that becomes frequent and normal and regular, our kids benefit from that because they learn that emotional expression is normal and okay to do. And then our partners start to learn that there's high value in being able to open up. They see a meaningful real-time payoff from that. We start to see that we're not strange or broken or weird. We can feel things and it's okay. But I would say if you've got podcasts that you're listening to or books that you prefer, I love Sue Johnson's book, Love Sense. I think that's a meaningful resource for couples. I think it's one of the best books on the market right now. That's certainly worthwhile for Audible or for handheld reading, whatever works for you. I really enjoy conversations that help us to feel meaningfully, emotionally engaged. And so if there's ways that you can ramp up your game, you know, on your personal level, wherever you are in your life, if you can find ways to feel on purpose and to feel exposed in a small, gentle way, express more, identify more than your instinct would suggest, you're probably on a meaningful track.
I love that. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. I feel inspired, and I feel like I know what my next training is going to be after brain spotting. I'm going to learn more about EFT. Can you tell our listeners where to find you, Kirk?
Sure. Yeah. I do a podcast every week called the Emotion Ally Podcast. You can find that anywhere that podcasts are accessed. And you can also find out more about the services that I provide on my website, which is kirkvosstherapy.com. I do online consultations for people around the world, and I am happy to help if there's folks out there that would like to work with me.
Awesome. And I will definitely put my plug in for Kirk's services and for your podcast. I've really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's it for another episode of Backseat Driver. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review, and share with a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for upcoming shows, you can email me at podcastbackseatdriver@gmail.com or find me on Instagram at Backseat Driver Podcast. Thanks for listening today. And remember, wherever you are, whatever you're experiencing, you are not alone. I'm here, breathing with you, helping you navigate the twists and turns of life from the backseat.